Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is Rosemary Jenkinson. Rosemary is an award-winning author who writes plays, short stories, recently a collection of poetry, and now she has published her debut novel, The Memorizers, with Arlen House. I started by asking her about her early reading experience. Rosemary, I know you are fresh back from the States and you've been touring with The Memorizers, which is your new novel, and we're going to get to that a wee bit later on. I'm going to start at the beginning with your book choices so we stay a bit anchored. You mentioned to me earlier that Lady Bird books were part of your childhood, and I've just scooted around the internet and looked at all the different covers to bring back some memories. But yeah, can you tell me about that, what those books meant to you and what kind of little girl you were?
The books, I suppose, I probably most liked was The Magic Porridge Pot, Rapunzel, Princess and the Pea. There were so many female characters in this. I think that really helped my imagination soar right from the beginning. And I was very bookish right from the start because my parents had a lot of books, shelves in their houses. No, I wasn't that rich. But yeah, and there was also in my room, there was a like a bookshelf and it went straight up to the ceiling and I used to climb up it. And I always think that's kind of like a metaphor for trying to find success in the book, in literary book world. And at school, I was always a more advanced reader than my class level was. And I used to win school prizes and they always had a choice of books out that you could choose what book you wanted. And I always went for the higher level. I was like, I went for Doctor Who and the Daleks, and I was not allowed this book. They just said, no, it's not your age group. You can't have it. And I just thought that was terrible. You know, it was just you were put in your place, even as a child, even though you were an avid reader and, yeah, ahead of the pack, really.
So you were reading voraciously and you were a little bit of a bit ahead, but you said it sparked your imagination then. You weren't creating little things around that age, were you?
No. Occasionally I'd write something for the school magazine or something, you know, but something simple. But I think, yeah, I started off probably writing ditties and songs or something. And then I suppose that developed into stories a bit later. I would say, I mean, I wrote a novel at 17, really. That was my kind of first thing.
Oh, wow.
I'm skipping right through my teenage years.
That's okay.
But we'll go into this. That, yeah, so I wrote this and sent, I couldn't type, obviously. So
my mum
got me a typist and paid for it, which was very kind of her, just to try and encourage me. And I remember the typist saying, does your mummy know you swear? It was like this terrible shock at what I'd written at 17 years old. So I was always kind of a bit out there on the writing. But
that's amazing at 17. And do you remember what it like? Do you remember? Well, of course you probably do. What was the title? What kind of a book was it?
It was about me and my friends at school. And it was a pretentious title. It was called Pasha Heard Wolf. A kind of nonsense medieval title.
And
so that was really my first. And I got one response from a publisher who said I should be a chat columnist.
Oh, wow.
So there you go. That I thought, oh, wow, I can be that. But of course, I didn't have the connections to be that. So it never happened.
It's still incredible that you did that at 17. Like, so around when you were doing your A-levels, like sixth year, basically, you just thought, all right, I'm going to. And like, because I know from what you sent me there about your choices, that, and I looked this up because I'd never heard of this novel, the Claudine novels, four novels, Claudine by Colette. And I was laughing about by her husband. What's her husband's name?
Willie.
Yes, that was it. I was going to only notice Willie. And I was like, okay, because, yeah, tell me, because you must have then read this book around the time that you wrote your novel and that was all happening. So you were 17. Yeah, so tell me about these books.
Yeah, so these books were about a schoolgirl called Claudine, who's 15, and they chart through her career, but it's really they're erotic, both heterosexual and lesbian sort of desires. And they're totally amazing. And I found them in the school library. And of course, I wasn't a member of the library, but I would go in and pinch them. And I was trying to get the very last one. I was just like, I have to read this tonight. I love these. And then the teacher wouldn't let me because I was a member of the society or not a member of the library. And I was raging, you know, at being prevented from reading this wonderful book. That really got me into sort of the whole eroticism thing. And I know my mother was a bit concerned at the time because she thought it would turn me into a lesbian. And that wasn't her image for me. So yeah, she had a few chats about not reading these, taking these too seriously, but I loved them myself. Her husband, Willie, locked her in the room to write them.
That's
Yeah, and
mad. Okay.
I'd love to be locked in. Somebody
It'd
should have locked me in as
be
well.
great. But like, and they were accredited to him though at first, is that right? Yeah, until,
Yeah,
but.
complete. Yeah, chauvinist pig. She then developed her own career from that, and yeah.
And what period was this? I can't remember. Was
Yeah,
it
that
with.
was 1905 or something. Yeah,
Yes.
it was very early, early
Yeah.
on, yes. And then she went on to doing great things and being on the stage naked in the 1920s. She was part of that whole 20s libertarian movement.
Wow, so I can see how this influenced you, all right, then. And, or,
Yeah.
you know, there's the theatre there, there's the kind of eroticism, there's the kind of boldness,
Yeah.
and just like doing it anyway, you know?
Yeah, and it was funny. Yeah, very, very amusing.
Isn't it strange that that was the door, like that those kind of books written in like the start of the 20th century was a door for you rather than, and you think what the door might be now for a 17-year-old, and that was your door. It's so incredible what leads people into it. I'm going to go and look her up now because I'd never, I'm sure I should have, probably have somewhere deep in the recesses of my brain, but maybe I've forgotten. But that's like a new thing to look up. So where did you go to university, Rosemary?
I went to Durham University
Oh,
in the
lovely.
north of England. So, yes, I tried to get into Cambridge, and that it was a source of resentment that I didn't get in. I know loads of people have that resentment. Hugh Edwards did as well. I remember he was, and then look what happened to him. He got so embittered, he did some very bad things. So,
Yes, well, yeah. So
there you go.
you did
Yeah.
this. You didn't get into Cambridge at, or Oxford. No, Cambridge, and you didn't apply for Oxford, but you did get into Durham. Durham's like it's incredible university, though, isn't it? It's one of the top.
It's a good one. Yeah, it was back then. I don't know now, but yeah,
Yeah.
it was very small university though. I didn't like it because it was like not a city, not a big city. Yeah.
But yeah, and you did English there, I presume.
I did medieval literature,
Oh, well.
unfortunately. Yeah, so it was a very, I just wanted to be original. The whole idea that I couldn't have just done straight English because it was too boring to me. So I decided medieval. I absolutely loathed it. I got through the degree as I could. One of the problems, I know I shouldn't say this, but I couldn't find the medieval library. It was so tucked away, and I assumed that all the books were taken out because every time I went to the English library, the books weren't there. And I
Oh,
just said,
Rosemary.
okay, so I can't really study this. I came out with a 2-2. Inevitably, I couldn't do very well because, yeah, a lot of my friends joke that I just couldn't find the library. And that was my whole story of university. Yeah, I shouldn't really admit that, but no, but I did. I hated the course anyway. So it was just like not for me. I tried to get through it as quickly as possible, just get a degree and leave, really.
Did you know during that period that you wanted to be a writer? Were you continuing to like write creatively after that first novel? And were you like, or like were play starting? Were you in the drama system? Were you in any of those kind of things like at university, or were you just like, get me out of here?
I was in the there was a creative writing, well, it was just a group. It wasn't run by any academics. It was just students. So I did go to that, but I didn't really, I think I just drank there rather than actually read anything of my own. So yeah, unfortunately, Durham really was a waste for me. And
It was.
the mad thing about it is I think I would have made a fantastic academic. In that way, I love books and I love lit crit, but it was just
Yeah.
the wrong place, the wrong time for
Wrong
me,
subject, the wrong
wrong
avenue.
subject, everything,
Yeah.
wrong
Yeah.
library, everything.
Well, at least it sort of taught you what you didn't want to do. That's as good as anything else in some
Yeah.
ways. And did you stay living in the UK then, or did you come back to Ireland or to the north or?
Well, my parents actually moved over to England on my last year of university, just as I had left university. So I no longer had a base in Northern Ireland, which was a pity because I think all through that troubles would have inspired my writing much more. And I also, my local voice would have been promulgated through being in Northern Ireland. Whereas in England, I felt a bit loose, sort of thing, not really belonging. Although I liked England, I mean, I liked England, no offense, really.
I'll not have that as the little trailer that we have sometimes. You know, I could just have that. I liked England. Fine, no offense, Rosemary Duck. Next episode. Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to pry into like, and then where did you go? And then what did you do? I'm just kind of trying to get a picture, because I know, like, I've read some of your short stories, and I've just finished your novel. I haven't seen any of your play. I know you're very, like, you've done so much, like, and poetry. So, like, you're a playwright and an award-winning playwright. Short stories are a completely different form, is wildly different, and now a novel. I mean, like, what do you think has sort of fed into all of that? Or just what, how do you, I mean, how do you explain how you do that? But do you feel kind of more confident in one area than another? Or do you feel kind of drawn to one more than the other? Or is it just fun to kind of try something different?
Yeah, I think it's fun. And I think we put those limits on ourselves, what we are, or in fact, that is actually imposed on the outside by literary organizations that say you are labeled one way or another. And writing is writing, in my opinion. I always say that the story about why I became a poet was because it was on my Wikipedia page that I was a poet, and I wasn't. And so therefore, I had to live up. It took me 10 years to live up to the fact, but I thought, yeah, if I'm labeled a poet and I see it all the time and people say I'm a poet, I have to be. So that was actually, I've complained about labeling, but actually in that case, labeling benefited me because it pushed me into being a poet.
Yes,
So
high
it's the
labels
wrong
liberated
label.
me.
Yes, high
Yeah.
labels liberated me. Yeah. Next time, call me a politician on my Wikipedia page and you never
Who
know.
knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
But one thing that's really, like, really comes through in your work for me anyway is humor and satire. And you're so, like, I wouldn't want to get on the wrong side if you put it that way, but you're so funny, but so can you can be quite cutting, but hilarious. I mean, I've just finished The Memorizers. I laughed so many times going through that book. And it is, would you call it a satire? I'm just because I'm looking at one of your choices here, and you said that this kind of, I don't know, did it turn you on to satire, or did that kind of, and this is The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yeah, it was a fantastic novel, and I was reading it in my 20s when I was very directionless in life and probably feeling, yeah, not happy with the way things were going. And this novel was really a satire about a black run over by a very wealthy trader, and it's really the how everyone jumps in on that and how the press. It was an accident because the trader was so frightened. He was in a black district. He got lost. And yeah, I don't want to go too much into that novel, but it's about how the various people, community leaders, journalists jump on the story and distort what actually happened. And the satire in that was amazing. They have women who are called social X-rays. That was what the author calls them because they're so skinny in New York. So I felt it was really brutal and showing exactly how unfair society was at a time when I felt it was unfair against me. And I thought, isn't that the way to express your frustrations in life? So satire. It's very much a way. I mean, and also it can be hilarious. It's the way of speaking truth to power in a way that is, well, I wouldn't say soft, but more palatable to the public.
Yeah, I agree. It's the sun rather than the wind, but no, that's ridiculous. It's not the sun rather than the wind. What the hell is that about?
I
It's just, God,
that
sometimes the inanities that come out of my mouth on
though.
this podcast. When I was reading The Memorizers, I thought, just like, not that it's risky, But why would I even think that? Do you know what I mean? That is it harder to write satire in 2025 than it would have been for your man writing Bonfire of the Vanities in 1980 or whenever it was?
It's the same kind of thing because in the 80s, political correctness was coming in, and that's really why he satirized that. And of course, we've also had wokeness come in, and that's why it's very easy to satirize. And of course, America at the minute is even more, increasingly more easier to satirize. And of course, UK and Ireland. So I think it's very, this is the time for satire if there ever was one.
Yeah. And you wrote did you write the mem you wrote the memorizers after your experience in Ukraine, didn't you? That was part of the process of researching the book.
Yeah, very much so. Five trips to Ukraine. And no, I mean, it wasn't researching the book. I was just kind of going there to see what would come creatively and to write some journalism. But yeah, it came out. I couldn't get the thoughts of Ukraine out of my head. I was completely obsessed by the signs or by the sounds and the sights of it. It was once you've been to those kind of war-torn areas, you can't forget.
Yeah, and there's a lot of those details in the memorizers. I think that you can just tell that's real, or that comes from something real. That's not, there's too many kind of small and very vivid details, that you think. So kind of along with the satire and everything else, there's this kind of real powerfulness to all of that. What you're saying really is that kind of fed into the novel, didn't it? Well, you didn't go there with an objective, you went there for an experience. I suppose, I mean, to ask you, did that change you? I mean, that's presumably it changed you going there.
I mean, it's changed in a way, I suppose, how close I am to the rest of Europe, and that also informed the novel. But yeah, it changes you in terms of, oh, thinking about your own life and the fragility of that. Certainly, being a witness shows you how quickly we can be, we have had the troubles, how quickly things can change overnight. So it's quite frightening, but also the bravery and awe-inspiringness of people, as well. So there's a lot going on.
And you've travelled quite a bit, haven't you, Rosemary? And you mentioned, I don't know what your trip to Poland was about or what you were doing at that time or what your experience in Poland was, but you mentioned a short story writer, again, someone that I have never read, that I looked up, and tell me if I'm pronouncing his name right. Is it Bruno Schulz?
That's it. Yes. Yeah,
Okay.
he's an amazing writer. And I had gone to Poland. I was teaching abroad. At that time, I was 30, 31, no, maybe 32. And I taught abroad in France, Greece, Czech Republic, as well as Poland, because I didn't really know what to do. I knew I wanted to keep moving. I couldn't really settle. And so these stories were just, they are of small town Poland in the 1930s and 40s. Bruno Schulz was murdered by the Gestapo, a Jewish writer. And they're the most beautiful lyrical short stories. Very little happens in them. They're like portraits or landscapes. But because the language is inherently musical, you don't need anything to happen. It's just a delight in itself. You just go into the rhythm and get lost. This was pre, I was in Poland in the year 2000, where they had not joined the European Union, and they were very old-fashioned still. And a lot of the roads were not even roads, it was clay tracks in
Wow.
the cities even, so it brought me back to that whole kind of wonder of that time.
Yeah. You were saying about getting lost in the story and in the rhythm and the lyricism of it. Kind of wonder how that kind of compares to reading or watching theatre. Like you mentioned the importance of being earnest here with a book you maybe go back to have a for fun and for comfort maybe. Tell me about the importance of being earnest and about the theatre and how that compares to maybe reading a novel or a short story.
Yeah, I to read a play is a very quick read. It's completely in your head. You don't have to visualize much. It's more just the characters unbound. And the thing about the importance of being earnest is it's his flippancy that I love. It's that whole lightness, and very few writers do it in that way. And I love I love writing that way myself. It's just like a complete irresponsibility. I don't morally care about anything. And that's what I love about Oscar Wilde. He just did not care. It was the most ridiculous. He said the most ridiculous things, like, yeah, to lose one parent, maybe regard as misfortune, to lose two is looks like carelessness. And it's utter ridiculous to say that to a baby. This is what it is, but it is. And I think it's pushing comedy to its absolute limit, but it's in the character. It's all character comedy, which is obviously the impetus for theatre. And yeah, so I love that. And I think it's, I like reading it as well because I know that he was such a dangerous writer to people. And I think I really appreciate that.
Someone, I really like the fact that you answered this question because a lot of people don't answer it. And this is about the book that you would leave in your burning house. And I'm always delighted when I see someone actually choose something because, and again, for the listeners, this is mischievous. We're not actually saying we're going to burn the book, you know. But yeah, tell me about the book that you would leave in the house to burn, Rosemary.
Yeah, so I was in Greece in, I think it was, yeah, oh, 1989, and I bought Isabel Allende's The House of Spirits, thinking this was going to be amazing. I'd read the blurbs and I was so excited about reading it. And I went to the beach on holiday and in Greece, and it was so terrible. It was magic realism, absolute rubbish. And what I did then was I could have left it in the hostel where I was staying for somebody to read, but it was just so bad. I ripped it up and put it in a bin. And I remember a friend saying at the time, that is sacrosanct, you have sacrilege. You know, you have, how dare you do that to a book? Somebody else could have loved that. And I'm just like, no, it's absolute overhyped. And this is the way I think. If something has been overhyped by the whole hype machine of publishers, just, yeah, destroy it if you don't like it. So I'd be never on ideological. I would never burn a book on ideological reasons because the why would I be scared of that? You know, let that. If somebody has an argument, even if I don't agree with it, if I feel that, you know, it has some validity, yes, let it live. But for absolute nonsense, words on a page meaning nothing.
So the last question I want to ask you is about an item that's not a book or an animal or a person that you would save from your burning house and what that would be.
Yes, it would be my mother's painting. Well, paintings, can I say
You
paintings
can, yeah.
collectively? Yeah, so before she died, she left them with me. She said, I want you to keep all these paintings. She was an artist and she'd always encouraged me to be a writer. I didn't inherit her talent for painting, unfortunately, but just painting with words in a different way. And yeah, I know I actually let her down because I said I would keep them all and I gave a couple of them away to relatives and my brother took a couple, which I didn't actually know about and I thought they'd been lost, but I rediscovered them. And so I actually let my mother down in a way that she said, keep them all together. But I have them and because she inspired me to be the artist I am, I would do that for her. I think it's important that I would preserve her legacy, even if my mother was always frustrated. She never got them out to art dealers in her life and probably suffered from a lot of lack of confidence. She hadn't been able to go to art school in London because her father hadn't got the money for it and she had to work. And there was so much she obviously, yeah, being a woman didn't achieve her potential. So it's up to me to sort of keep this. And it's up to me to achieve my potential also through this. And in fact, in marching season, I put all her paintings in between the stories. It was Alan Hayes, my publisher, suggested that. And it was I just loved that because it was like she was dead, but it's our double talent going into that book.
Ah, that's gorgeous. That is a legacy. That's beautiful. Oh,
I like it. Yeah.
Rosemary, I'm going to go to your novel now. I know we've kind of touched on it just during our chat, but you can tell our listeners a little bit about the premise of the book.
The Memorizers is about Western Front West, which is Ireland in 2062, and it's about a journalist, Joe Elliott, who has been injured in a drone attack and wants to discover why she was on the front line during that period when she was injured, but she doesn't know why because her memories are affected by the bomb blasts. So that's really what it's about, but it's about this whole world and trying to find the truth through what the government says. There's a lot of lies going on, and it's during a war that Sino-Russians have invaded. That's really the context of the book.
It's PN, isn't it? Post-nuclear.
Yeah, it's post-nuclear, yes. Because I imagine in 1925, because of this whole Putin thing about possibly unleashing a nuclear war, I imagined it would be this year. So it is post-nuclear, about 37 years after that. And in fact, only London was hit by the nuclear bomb because I didn't want a total destruction wasteland. So it's kind of recognizable, and it's kind of the psycho geography is it is Belfast, but it is also Ukraine at the same time. So I had this fusion in my mind of putting the two together.
I finished it the other night, just for our listeners, and it's got so many interesting concepts. If you're into that kind of, what is freedom, what is truth, what is democracy, power, trust, self-censorship, and there's some great aphorisms. I love it. Which it reminded me a little bit of, was it Brave New World or 1984 that had all the, like, ending is better than mending, and all the, it reminded me of that, but I can't remember which one it is. But that kind of the state with their kind of advertising.
I think Brave New World had that. I can't remember because it's been so many years since I read that one, but definitely 1984 has all of those Big Brother is watching you and all of these slogans. And of
Yes.
course, Animal Farm, two legs bad, four legs
That's
good, all
good.
of these. So it's very much a George Orwell thing. But I mean, I kind of invented my own original ones, and it was word crime, whereas George Orwell was thought crime. So it's just looking at those things that he used and also readapting for current purposes, but making new slogans as well, because I have a grand commander, a military commander who is obviously the big brother of his era.
Yes,
Yeah.
and hence the cover as well, which is fantastic. And did you have a hand in the cover? I was looking at that said cover, Rosemary Jenkinson, and
Oh, yes, I did have a hand. It was my vision to have the half a face because the Grand Commander uses both their they pronouns, they're half female, half male. And so it was really the idea of that in our kind of, it's also in modern society that we have that sort of sexual blurredness and how it would be used in the future for control.
yeah,
Yeah,
excellent.
so subverting really what is the present into the future.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. So okay, you're going to read a little passage for us, and
I
maybe just,
will indeed. Yes. So this is during the dememorization surgery later in the book. This is much later. "Don't try to hide anything," said Dr. Morgan. "Your impulse will be like a dog burying a bone. The deeper you hide it, the more invasive your treatment will be. You might lose everything, but I'm doing all I can to save your short-term recall function. I can see your connectome cells lighting up on screen as you access every memory." I tried harder. "It's Vig." Jake had green eyes and black hair. "You're sure his eyes were green?" Sudden doubt hit me. "I don't know. Were they more of a greenish hazel?" "Good woman, you're showing progress." "Confusion is progress?" I asked. "Confusion followed by clarity. I'm not trying to destroy you. I'm making you quiescent. Your path will go from wrong thinking to confusion to enlightenment." Out of nowhere, I felt a wave of gratitude to Dr. Morgan. He was my teacher, my guide, and I immediately realized I'd do anything to get out of there. I'd leave all my memories on this table if I had to. What did it matter anymore, this dark-haired man I hadn't seen in years? All he ever did was give me pangs of regret. What good had that ever done me? I'd be mad not to grab this chance at a new life with both hands. It finally registered with me that this was my alternative reality. I'd actually found it. The Grand Commander says the past must not be in the present. It must stay in the past, said Dr. Morgan. Repeat it. The past must not be in the present. It must stay in the past. The past must not be in the present. It must stay in the past. I started slurring the words, but Dr. Morgan barked at me to concentrate. I tried to control myself. This was not a place of torture, but of learning. If I attended to my studies, I'd reach a higher level of consciousness, one that would mean I was free physically and mentally. Well done, said Dr. Morgan, satisfied. Now you know I'm not torturing you. The torture was all in your own head. You were an expert in self-torture. Once you decided on a collision course with the state, there was no way out. You always wanted to be hurt by the government, and that's why you went to find books in the old library. What were those books about? Peace in this country. There never was real peace. Where did you put the book? The facts were slow to come to me. I didn't put it anywhere. Scott took it. Don't prevaricate. Where did the book go? He said. I hesitated, and the sharp shock of pain was dialed up to 11. I cried out for mercy. Please, please. You disappoint me. Just when we were making progress.
You've been listening to the wonderful Rosemary Jenkinson, whose debut novel, The Memorizers, is out now with Arlen House.